friends and everyone who is concerned with where the world is going. Those of you who want to see us go in a better direction, you've come to the right place. If you're a new listener, good to have you with us. I'm Henrik Palmgren. I'm from Sweden, and this is Red Ice Radio. Our website where you can find more is redicecreations.com. I hope that you're having a good last few days here as we are coming to a close for this year. It's amazing how quick this one has went by. We have learned a lot, as we do each year, and of course we're looking forward to stepping up our game going into next year and get even more important work and research to you. The topic today is philosophy. We are going to talk about how philosophy is being used against us, specifically that of the establishment, and how they're using this to create traps and fabrications. Entire worlds, in fact, reality bubbles that lead people into complete oblivion. Jay Dyer is a writer and researcher from the southern U.S. who obtained his Bachelor's of Arts in Philosophy, while his graduate work focused on the interplay of literary theory, espionage, and philosophy. His website, jaysanalysis.com, is dedicated to investigating the deeper themes and messages found in our globalist pseudoculture, illustrating the connections between philosophy, metaphysics, secret societies, Hollywood, psychological warfare, and comparative religion. Welcome, Jay. Thank you so much for coming on the program with us. Good talking with you today. Hope you're having a good day.
I am, Henrik. It's a little bit chilly here, but relatively warm for Christmas time.
Well, that's good. Where are you about, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm in the southern U.S., so I'm coming to you from the middle of nowhere, Rednecksville.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's cool. We like rednecks. You know?
In a good way.
Well, you know, that's a derogatory term. We've learned that about the slavery and all those issues, right? That's when redneck rose, I think. So
it is. You're right. Yeah. But you know, around here, we're pretty fine with it. You know, the South is still not PC for the most part, so we can actually enjoy that.
Well, that's good. That's one thing we like. Now, tell us a little bit about your grad work, your background a bit. I know you started the website, of course, it's jaysanalysis.com. You have a lot of good stuff on there, and there's some of these things I want to talk more with you about a little bit later here, but just give us a little bit of background on how you got into the kind of writing that you're doing today, Jay.
Yeah, well, I guess around 18, 19, 20, I was doing undergrad stuff and I was focusing on philosophy. Had a Protestant religious upbringing, evangelical, kind of drifted out of that in college and into, you know, different ideas, working with different philosophies. That's a good thing about philosophy, is it gets you to, look objectively at other people's positions, right? Rather than coming at it from a purely myopic standpoint, you're asked to, you know, be objective and consider the opposing view. So I've always appreciated that kind of thinking. And in undergrad, I just kind of got the idea. I had a buddy who worked at Xerox, and he said, you know what, you ought to start a website. And I said, well, I don't really know what would we do? He said, well, you know, you're into this conspiracy stuff, you're into philosophy, why don't you, you know, just put your ideas out there, you're not a bad writer. So I came across an article a long time ago. It was probably one of the first conspiracy movie articles on the web, and it's an old analysis by Michael Hoffman of the movie Conspiracy Theory. And I thought, man, that's a really cool idea. What if you had a site that was just dedicated largely to, you know, looking at the interplay of not just fiction or not just philosophy, because there's a million sites that deal with, you know, movies or literature or philosophy, but what about something that integrated all of them? So it's just kind of a reflection, really, of my own interests. And the great thing about grad school, relatively great, I guess it's changing over time, but you can still tailor what you want to focus on in grad school to kind of your own interests. So what I did was just integrated the ideas of classical mythology, you know, the classics of Western tradition, philosophy, conspiracy, comparative religion, and tied it into something relevant to modern day living, which is, of course, mass media. Unfortunately, the mass media complex is something that bombards and attacks us every day. So I got the idea to focus on the way that mass media uses psychological warfare techniques in fiction and in film. So what you see at Jay's analysis is really just, like I said, a reflection of my own interests, my own thoughts on things. It's kind of independent. It's not really affiliated with the Republican Party or, you know, this or that movement or whatever. It's just all ideas that I have. So that's where we're at. And that's what I did in grad school was look at Ian Fleming's character, James Bond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how Bond is kind of an iconic image of Western capitalist society that kind of it's at that apex. He's a lot of times in the literature analyzed as kind of a Nietzschean Übermensch, but at the same time, he kind of represents the decline of the West, you know, something like Spengler would talk about. So it's kind of a big blender. Sometimes I joke that it's the stuff I do is kind of a philosophical tabloid.
That's cool though. I like that. That is a really cool.
It's something to, it's different and it gets people thinking. That's what I like to do. I like to get people, questioning assumptions. That's a lot of what I do. So my main focus in analytical philosophy and in metaphysics was the German word is Weltanschauungskrieg, which is worldview warfare.
Yeah.
So to looking at how narratives are created to essentially program people, right, and propaganda, things like that. So yeah, most of the time, unfortunately, that's used in a bad way, but it doesn't have to be a bad way. I mean, you can have good propaganda too. So that's what it's all about.
Well, excellent. There's a lot there, of course, to go deeper into. Why don't we just talk a little bit more about kind of what you found when it comes to psychological warfare, and specifically, I mean, I want to get into the entertainment industry of this too a little bit later, of how sure. how that's used and everything else. But of course, we, just as you rightly say, we're definitely inundated with propaganda left, right, and center all the time. Most people are, kind of like a fish in water. We're bathing in it. We're not really sure, or aware of it per se. So how do you kind of put yourself outside of yourself to be able to view what you're being subjected to when it comes to the media and entertainment, things like that?
Well, I think the first step, at least in my experience, was even though I was at a state school, I was fortunate enough in undergrad classes to be taught kind of the vestiges, I guess, of what we would call a classical education. So you're still going to get, logic. You're still going to get critical thinking. You're still going to engage in rhetoric. You know, all these things are part of the classical trivium and quadrivium. And these are really, these are your building blocks for how to formulate a worldview or for how to think, how to approach the world. And most people just simply don't get that. You know, I mean, I think the only people who take philosophy classes tend to be, somebody going into law or something like that. You know, they might take, philosophy 101, or they might take critical thinking. And so it's kind of been, shelved off to the liberal arts, quote unquote, section of the university, which is kind of a little back room where there's a ponytailed Marxist lesbian who's indoctrinating you with some nonsense.
Yeah.
But like I said, I mean, you can still kind of find the skeletal remains of a classical education. So that's kind of the first starting point, is getting, obtaining the skills and the ability to critically think and to use logic and to reason through argumentation. And so I was engaged in a lot of debate in college. In fact, my sophomore year, I actually debated one of my professors publicly, which was a lot of fun. It was actually won.
Oh, yeah.
You may not feel that way, but what it was, though, was great practice. So the practice of debate, over the years of my undergrad, is what I think gave me, at least personally, the ability to look at everything from a critical perspective, not just swallowing things, but you're doing your own research, doing your own thought, without being force-fed. Most people grow up, unfortunately, and they just kind of accept whatever they've grown up with. Now, granted, I know that sounds kind of paradoxical with the idea of traditionalism, but you know, one of the things I try to reconcile and work with at my site is that very question, the paradox of, you know, on the one hand, you know, living organically according to the tradition that you are a part of, broadly speaking, yet at the same time having a critical eye and trying to, you know, filter out wheat from chaff. So I really think that, to make a long story short, I think philosophy was the best way that I was able to gain, you know, critical thinking skills to look at mass media, mass culture, pop culture, all this, like you said, sea that we swim in, and try to just get rid of all the garbage, you know, get the programming out of the way and, you know, find some sanity.
Yeah, indeed. Very good. Now, let's talk a little bit more about the philosophy of, let's focus kind of on the West a little bit by using, you know, or what we've heard, at least in the conspiracy movement, I'd say they have focused a lot on the dialectic, Hegel, of course, in particular, and how this has been adopted as kind of a method of how the elites get a lot of their nastiness, for lack of a better term, done in the world. How, right. From your perspective, how do you view the dialectic and Hegel? I know that there's some people who really, you know, admire, of course, what he brought to the world, and that it's based on something, you know, real and effective and whatnot. And that might or might not be true, but the fact is, it's of course how we're using these different tools to against or for us. But tell us more about the dialectic in Hegel.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, you have to go back a little bit, well, a good bit earlier than Hegel, because in my view, the history of Western philosophy is kind of a footnote of dialectics all the way down. So yeah. from Plato and Aristotle, you have an early dialectic at work between, you know, Plato kind of focusing on, you know, the realm of the forms, which is outside of the immediate, you know, physical, visible realm. And he focuses on universals. And for those that don't know, universal is something that's a general metaphysical category or essence or substance of a thing that kind of defines or makes the thing what it is. Sometimes it's spoken of as an essence. And what Aristotle did, in contrast to Plato, was sort of localize that, put it in the immediate, and say that there's not really anything out there. What we're looking for, this form, this essence, is actually just in the thing right here. So even though Plato had a what's called a participatory view, where individual objects do, in a metaphysical way, participate in universals, Aristotle takes a decidedly empirical turn in philosophy, and he gets us to focus on the here and now. And there's good and bad to that. But one thing that getting us focusing on the here and now does is it can also get us focused on materialism. So even though Aristotle is not a rank materialist, what we see is kind of the seeds of a trend in the history of Western thought that would blossom at the time of the Enlightenment, with thinkers like Locke, Berkeley, Hume. And this would, in my view, from my research, would really be capitalized by the power elites of the Western establishment, who realized that you could take philosophies and engineer them just like you could engineer anything else. So, you know, in, like you said, in the conspiracy world, conspiracy genre, and alternative media, you know, we talk a lot about the attack that comes from food, the attack that comes in, you know, pop culture, whatever.
Yeah.
But I don't, not many people have focused on the attack that's come through philosophy, because philosophy used to be, you know, something that was integral to a university education. I heard your interview with Kerry Bolton, and that was really good. He kind of touched on a lot of the same stuff that I talk about at my site.
Yeah.
But again, to bring it back home to Hegel, you have this back and forth between, you know, focusing on the here and now and focusing on the, you know, the eternal, the absolute, and so forth, the Platonists and the Aristotelians. That itself is a kind of a dialectic. It's setting, you know, the eternal, the atemporal, over against the historical and the temporal. So what you have in the history of the West is, philosophically, people trying to create systems or narratives or explanations that in some way fix these problems, right? So when you have a dialectic within philosophy, you have basically three branches. You have knowledge, which is epistemology. You have metaphysics, which is being or reality or ontology sometimes. And you have ethics and sometimes aesthetics as well, which is the theory of beauty. And so each of these branches is affected when you have something like a dialectic. If you have a dialectic of monism, let's say, which is the idea that all reality is one type of thing and that's it. Okay, so we think about maybe modern physicalism or reductionist materialism is a monistic position. So it views all of reality as only and simply one kind of stuff, and maybe just kind of stacked on each other at different levels. But at base, there's nothing beyond just, you know, matter, you know, so atomism basically.
Yeah.
And this comes to the fore with Newton. Newton really popularizes atomism, and through powerful entities like the Royal Society, you know, rich families that end up backing that, we kind of, even that early on, in my view, were given kind of philosophical heroes, you know, people like John Locke and Newton. And we're not taught about people like, say, Leibniz. Leibniz is a very important philosopher who, you know, kind of co-founded calculus with Newton. But all we know about is Newton. You know, Newton's kind of our great hero, just like, you know, Martin Luther King is presented in education as sort of the only great hero American in the last, 100 years. You know, Newton's kind of the only great scientist that we know about other than maybe Einstein or something like that. But that's not actually right. The case. You know, you have people like Leibniz, like I said, and when you study, if you look at computers, I mean, Leibniz is a major figure in the development of the computer. So
yeah.
Basically, what dialectics does is allow powerful entities to utilize a strategy of a form of psychological warfare through the indoctrination of worldviews as a whole. And so once we're trapped in empiricism, empiricism is the idea that knowledge only and strictly comes through the five senses. So your sense experience is basically all that you have. The problem with these kinds of philosophies is that they quickly lead to dead ends, and dead end philosophies tend to get us not living well. And that's the main problem. So we're affected, even though we might not immediately think about it. If we have a bad philosophy of knowledge or how we know things, or if we don't have critical thinking, well, that's going to affect the way that we live. We're not going to be able to make, you know, rational, sensible choices. I mean, that's kind of common sense, but from the perspective of the controllers, the social engineers, people like that, they know that. So they know that you can weaponize philosophy to get people to think kind of down a wrong chain of argument, right? To a dead end.
Yeah.
And once you're in a dead end like that, you are basically putty for the system to mold you as it wants.
That's very interesting. Speak about more about that. Utilize a form of kind of, yeah, using philosophy as psychological warfare, and of course being trapped in this bubble. I've always wondered this myself. It's like, I wonder if they believe some of the things that they teach themselves. I mean, we can talk about the elite specifically, but it feels like if this is for the mass consumption of people, maybe they have a completely different view on history, on mankind, on everything that's being done, basically. And this is just something that, you know, we are taught and that we're stuck in, if people even at all are interested in the deeper questions, that is.
Oh, absolutely. I think that one of the things I've focused on recently is the idea of what I call hidden metaphysics. And by this, I don't necessarily mean some, fluffy, effeminate, new agey type of thing where you go with whatever you feel. No, I'm actually talking about an alternate branch of metaphysics that has been suppressed in the West. And one of the reasons that I think that is that we have numerous prominent thinkers in the West who, you know, came to some level of fame and basically either had their careers ruined or were shot down or whatever. They basically were destroyed. One great example is Kurt Gödel. Gödel was more so in the Platonic line of thinking. And there's an interesting story about Gödel, again, a very, very famous mathematician, logician. You know, he had these debates with Bertrand Russell, and Russell's sort of the apex of the Western empiricist materialist tradition. Russell and Gödel have this interaction, and Gödel gets kind of freaked out because he starts to see where the thought that Russell espouses from, you know, the Fabian socialists and these Royal Society empiricists, where it's taking the world, and it's obviously taking the world to, you know, Brave New World 1984 type of a situation.
Yeah.
And so I think Gödel saw that, and he also claims, and again, I don't know if this is true, but he claimed to have discovered suppressed documents in Leibniz. Leibniz worked on what he called a Characteristica Universalis, which is an attempt to basically create a universal symbolic language, and that, you know, that he thought that this could be used for computers, computational systems. And apparently these, I believe it was Vienna, these Vienna manuscripts had been suppressed and taken or stolen or something like that. And that got Gödel worried. There were similar questions about some of the manuscripts of Edmund Husserl, also within kind of the Platonic tradition. Some of his documents and manuscripts were suppressed. And then Gödel, of course, with his famous incompleteness theorems, believe that his views were being suppressed as well. So on the one hand, you know, we could chalk this up to, you know, paranoid mathematical geniuses, or we might consider the possibility that, you know, maybe there actually is a hidden metaphysics when we consider people like Nikola Tesla. You know, I didn't want to, I'm not a Tesla expert. You know, I'm more of a philosophy guy, but what I've seen in Tesla, what I've looked at, it seems to be a similar idea. You know, Tesla had all these amazing theories based on ether. You know, he thought that there was actually a higher level of reality that could be tapped into, kind of a higher dimension, so forth. Again, fitting roughly in that sort of Platonic tradition. And, you know, that's in my view, kind of the way he was able to do a lot of what he did. So basically, in my view, it comes down to presuppositions, which are kind of the grounding assumptions of worldviews that we have. And if the presuppositions, the grounding assumptions that we have about the world are wrong, we're going to be kind of, I liken it to a guy who's got one foot nailed to the ground running in a circle, right? And he's just kind of like, he's kind of running around in a circle, just looking at the ground, never able to look up beyond. And, you know, to use a classic philosophy trope, you know, the allegory of the cave, right? I mean, if we're always trapped in the level of appearances, and what greater example of that than pop culture, mass media, you know, this synthetic veil of reality that's being pulled over our eyes that keeps us in the cave. So, yeah, I mean, you can really plumb the depths of this stuff and find alternate versions of things that don't have to be irrational or you know, flights of new age fancy. I mean, you can actually find hard, you know, hard scientific minds like a Gödel or a Tesla that are working on a different metaphysic. And I think this has really been held back from people.
Very interesting. Yeah, I like that too. It's excellent because usually, as you say, you kind of are led down a path where it's either or. It's either this materialist reductionist view, or it's a very flighty new agey kind of approach. And I've always felt the same, that there's got to be somewhere in between where you still can work empirically, you can prove things, you can find things out. But that doesn't mean that we have all the answers now. It doesn't mean that everything we experience with the five senses, that is it. You know, there has to be more here. So that's fascinating. And so just to kind of follow on from that, it's, to me, it feels like we've been kind of sidetracked, and specifically in the West, we have a tradition in the West of pushing, you know, forward into new territory, expanding in different things, and really, being behind some of these really explosive concepts and thoughts. But to a certain degree, it's like we've been led down the wrong path, and it's also one of the reasons why we see, I think, a decline in the West as well. So how would you say that the elite have been using their worldview and philosophy to kind of get us where they are today. And then later we can talk about how to potentially get ourselves out of that.
Right. Well, the technological technique of dialectics in terms of worldview warfare is the greatest example I could think of would be like the Frankfurt School. So in my, my undergrad, I was my, advisor in, I don't know how it is in Sweden, but in America, you have kind of this guru handler, not literally a CIA handler.
Right. Yeah, I got it.
But he's supposed to be, you know, your director who's, you know, telling you what classes to take and all this stuff throughout your undergrad. This guy was actually a good guy. He overall was good at philosophy, and he left his younger days of Marxism. So he wasn't all bad. But he had been taught by a guy who had what I call Marxistolic succession, if you know about apostolic succession in the Catholic tradition.
Tell us just briefly about that.
Well, this guy, I don't know, I forget the name of his professor, but he did his PhD under a guy from who had, I think had been taught by Habermas. So it was somebody from directly from the Frankfurt School tradition. And so, you know, I had plenty of classes that dealt with critical theory, which is a later school of Marxism out of the Frankfurt School.
Yeah.
That dealt a lot with culture. So once again, that tie in with pop culture was there in my undergrad. But what we have with the Frankfurt School is, again, probably the preeminent example of Western elites taking a school of philosophy and weaponizing it for the purpose of subversion. So when you read Adorno, you see him saying explicitly, you know, we need to destroy the arts. We need to, you know, make music into dissonance and noise and destroy harmony. And then he says right after that, like, then we'll have people having sex with animals.
Right.
I mean, that's what lovely. He says. Like, he's wonderful. Like, he goes from that right to bestiality. So, and the point being that, you know, this goes all the way back to Plato too. Plato recognized in the Republic that you could weaponize the arts, and that's why they were somewhat of a danger. So this is done, especially in Marxism, through dialectics. And what Marx did, as a lot of people know, you know, he turned Hegel on his head. There's a lot of good in Hegel, a lot of bad in Hegel. So I have a love-hate view of Hegel.
A lot of people do, yeah.
Yeah. But he is more in line with the Platonic type of tradition. So he is an idealist. Obviously, he's like the ultimate idealist. I don't mean idealist in the parochial sense, but in the metaphysical sense of thinking that all that exists is idea or psyche. So what, you know, Marx did was sort of flip this and make it a dialectical materialism. And dialectical materialism is the idea that change, evolution, progress, so forth, really only happens by basically forces colliding. And so we all know about the, you know, class struggle. And so, you know, for Marx, there was the class struggle between the bourgeois and the proletariat that would bring about the advance of civilization, ultimately towards some form of libertarianism as it passed through many stages of, you know, state communism, so forth. Mm. But a lot of people don't know that Marx was not anti-capitalist. You know, he thought that capitalism was a necessary stage on the way to wherever communism would go. You know, Marx hoped that it would go towards, you know, a world proletariat state where you could, you know, be free to do whatever you wanted to, you know, all day long.
Yeah.
So there's actually a kind of a libertarian strain in Marx that might anger a lot of people out there, but but it's the truth. I mean, and I'm not a Marxist, obviously, but all that metaphysical stuff kind of dropped away. And so what retained with Marxism was cultural Marxism. So that's kind of the force that Marxism gave to, you know, the last century and our century. Well, obviously, the last century, there was a lot of death that Marxism brought about. But in our day, it's not so much, you know, state entities that literally affirm Marx's Das Kapital, but it's more so the Frankfurt School critical theory views of culture that are the main threat from Marxism.
Well, that's interesting. You know, that's why they've shifted over to culture. That, I mean, that's really the interface here between things like the Frankfurt School and, right, and where we've ended up today as well, where they've realized that with the aid of culture, with this, well, it's really a reality bubble, right? They've said, we can shape the hearts of minds of people. We can shape their desires. We can do, we can form them however we want, but we have to take control of those things that you know, pushes the ideas, that pushes the aspirations and all things. And in our world, of course, that is music, that is movies, that is theater and novels and things like this, right? So there's an interface here between, you know, what they've sought to establish in the West and, of course, where we find ourselves today, you know?
Yeah, going back to the Enlightenment and the Enlightenment view of man and anthropology, that empiricist tradition gave us the idea of a tabula rasa, which is that man's a blank slate. It also gave us the idea that the soul is the exact same thing as the psyche. So in or certain Eastern traditions, you have an idea that man's a tripartite being, that he has a body, soul, and a spirit. But from the time of Augustine on in the West, there's the clear adoption of the idea that man is a binary unit of body and soul. And there's a dialectic that's placed between body and soul. Again, soul being identified with psyche or mind or intellect. So from Augustine on up, you have the rise of the scholastic tradition. And the scholastic tradition in the medieval West, with Aquinas, adopted pretty heavy degrees of Aristotelianism. And that led to, in contrast to a more Platonic idea that man, even though Plato's idea was that that man had a past life, and that in this life he's kind of just, it's transmigration of souls, reincarnation type of view. My personal beliefs, I don't adhere to that. But what is there is the idea of a soul that is born with innate ideas or an innate quality. But with the adoption of empiricism, it's the opposite of that. You have the adoption of the idea that it's a blank slate that can then be engineered environmentally. And once you adopt that idea, it's not too far down the road, especially with empiricism, that you end up in materialism. And so at that point, man is basically just kind of a walking biological computer. And if you're just a walking biological computer and your mind is just kind of a camcorder, well, it stands to reason that all that we need to do to change man is alter his environment.
Right.
So there's a complete neglect of the idea of, you know, man having any inborn qualities or innate ideas or a soul. In other words, the soul eventually gets dropped off, right? Because you don't empirically see the soul.
Right.
I mean, it's not something that's quantifiable. So, you know, Ganon talked about the reign of quantity. So that this reign of quantity gives rise to a completely behaviorist, Pavlovian view where man can just be given a download, like Alan Watt talks about that quite a bit. That you're on a daily basis downloaded with the new update for whatever the system wants. And so even though we do see people operating that way, in my view, it's against nature. That's not man's nature. Man does have a soul. He does have innate qualities and ideas that he's born with. In fact, the whole discovery of DNA kind of confirms that idea.
Yeah.
So all of that goes very contrary to the Marxist, empiricist, materialist, reductionist, physicalist, blah, 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 anthropology, which is disastrous.
Well, exactly. Anthropology is, because, I mean, that's really where we are today when we consider, biology and, the Franz Boas of this world and how they, have rewritten these kinds of, rules of what we are, because today it's all talk about biology. We're not hardly even allowed to say that we are, things are heredity. There are things there which we are just born into the world with. And they kind of have this view that you can just reshape whoever you want into anything you want, right? So, and that's an erroneous view in my book. This is another one of these methods they've used against us to try to manipulate us, right?
Exactly. This is an older view. I think Spengler was correct. Yagi talks about this too, to speak about older Enlightenment narratives – still lingering. I mean, the advancements that we've had in DNA, in computer sciences, even the kind of out there stuff with Tesla that I mentioned, all of this goes completely contrary to the narrative of what you're talking about, of that Frankfurt School view, of that technocratic, you know, Fabian, Bertrand Russell view of humanity. So all of that goes contrary to that, but they still prop it up. Okay, there was a great story of there was Edmund Husserl's philosophical mentor was a guy named Franz Brentano, and Brentano was in this tradition of empiricism, and he was very dedicated to what's called psychologism, and this is basically a psychiatric version of empiricism, where it focuses on basically human desires as the motivating factor in our actions and our volitions from a radically empiricist perspective. And Husserl was studying under Brentano, and you know, formulated a lot of good points just from a logical perspective about how radical empiricism doesn't work. And you know, he brought this to Brentano, and again, empiricism was not new. You have all the way back to David Hume, and even to medieval thinkers who were in the empiricist tradition that were emphasizing this radically skeptical view of things. Husserl brought, you know, a really strong refutation of psychologism to Brentano when he said, you know, you believe everything is, you know, only what we can derive from sense experience. Well, yeah. Right. And he says, well, that truth itself is not something learned from sense experience, right?
Right.
No, it's not. There's nothing in sense experience that will tell you that everything is only sense experience.
Right.
It's a logical leap that is what we call a non sequitur. It doesn't follow from a whole bunch of sense experiences that therefore only what we can know is sense experience. So, you know, Husserl says this, and later when he reflected and wrote about it, he said something to the effect of, I think if I'm remembering it right, he said, it's like a vampire. This radical skeptical empiricism is like you can refute it so many times with philosophy, with logic, but it just keeps coming back to life. Like, you know, there's never a wooden stake or you know, that finally gets rid of it.
Right.
And so it's just this lingering myth. And this is actually one good point that the Frankfurt School had when they took, with Horkheimer and Adorno, they took more of a Nietzschean term when they realized that the Marxist hope, the Marxist gospel was not working. They took more of a Nietzschean darker turn, and they said, you know, it kind of looks like all this narrative, this grand narrative that we've built up, this new mythology that we've built up about man and anthropology since the Enlightenment, it kind of looks like it's dying, and it kind of looks like it was just another grand narrative, right? So it's compared to, say, a gospel of Christianity. You know, the gospel message is now the gospel message of scientific technocracy.
Exactly.
And you know, the priests in lab coats, basically. So
yeah.
So you know, thinkers like Foucault have made that connection where we've just traded one mythology and priest class for a new mythology and priest class. So that's actually one good point that the Frankfurt School and postmodern writers do have.
I didn't know they recognized that or even that they took that turn, but even if they did, it's not something that they've said, okay, so let's take this in another path now. It's more
their idea in, they have a book called Dialectic of Enlightenment, which actually is worth reading. They almost kind of take an esoteric, mystical turn in the book, oddly enough. They go back to analyzing language. And of course, we know Marx was all about sitting in libraries for 18 hours a day, figuring out how to manipulate language. That was one of the things he did as a young guy.
Yep.
And so the Marxist, you know, linguistic tricks that came to be adopted by the Frankfurt School were analyzed, and they kind of took a primal view of, well, maybe if we just return to some kind of primal man. In other words, they basically get the idea that We need a new man. And rather than it being the collective Marxist new man, maybe there could arise, individual man or something like that out of the ashes of the West. So their view is still, I mean, it's still Marxist and it's cultural Marxist, but they kind of get the idea that, well, maybe we just need to crash the whole Western system for something better to rise out of the ashes. So kind of back to that cyclical, Phoenix from the ashes type of view.
Well, yeah, but that's still really destructive, right? They've set about to destroy the West in its path to.
I'm not advocating.
No, sure. I guess I get that. No, but
it's just interesting to see the I think Jonathan Bowden has a good lecture that he did on this very thing too. And it was, when I heard it, it was interesting because it was exactly what, my Frankfurt School professor was telling me, that with Dialectic of Enlightenment, they took a darker turn and thought, well, burn it all down. And you see that in the radical left. You see
exactly. That's just it. That's what you see. And then at the same time, I feel that there is a repackaging here because we've seen the rise of a kind of moral relativism kind of playing into New Age. We can't really know anything. It's kind of the quantum path to this. And I've seen at least how this also now has started to kind of merge into parts of the left. When I did some research on the early days of the Fabian Society, for example, most of those actually came out of a spiritualist, angle. And a lot of them were like, out hunting ghosts and stuff like that. And again, it doesn't mean that it's all false or something, but it means that they came from this kind of, I think the appeal to utopianism here, it's quite easy for them because it's something that they've imagined and it's not based on something real. But do you see how this kind of transformation of sorts taken place of the left as well?
Absolutely. I mean, look at the rise of magic traditions or whatever you want to call it, occult superstitions, whatever, that really have no basis in fact. They're just about they're just about egoism. They're just about, what's that stupid, the secret, that kind
of. Yeah, exactly. Well,
all of this New Age stuff is 100% funded by the big foundations, the big think tanks, the UN, they've forever promoted all these New Age ideas, back to con woman or man. She looks kind of like a man. I don't know. She's Helen Helena Blavatsky, was noted for con artistry, things like that. So I think the social engineers, whatever their personal views of esoteric occult stuff is, I don't know. But, early on in the Dialectic of Enlightenment, they talk about magic. They talk about, early, primeval savages, whatever, developing language based around their views of magic and the gods. So whether they believed in it as a metaphysical reality or not, they saw it as something that could be used as a technique. So really it's about what works more so than I don't think they really care about what's objectively metaphysically true. It's just a matter of, can we utilize not just philosophy, not just pop culture as a weapon, but can we utilize language as a weapon too?
Yeah. Very interesting. So as one bubble kind of begins to fade, they realize that the faith in one system, they not only need to, invent few, they need to have more waiting in the wings ready to take that place once that begins to fade. And we ultimately leaving us never to really kind of experience true reality, but living in these manufactured bubbles. It's kind of a nightmare. It's a mental prison, really, when you think about
it. One of the evil, ugly cousins of empiricism is pragmatism. Empiricism gave birth to the only school of philosophy that America is known for. Can you guess? Pragmatism.
Right, right.
doesn't that say quite a bit right there? That, with a totally consumerist, monopolistic capitalist perspective, naturally, radical pragmatism would be the only school of philosophy that America would produce. And this is, again, an offshoot of radical empiricism, because in this kind of technocratic view, really, again, all you're concerned with is what works. So if the proletariat revolution didn't happen, what did happen? Well, Mao did have a cultural revolution that destroyed a whole bunch of, you know, traditional Chinese culture. Mm-hmm. So that worked. You know, the economics might not have worked, but well, I guess the economics worked to destroy things. So in that regard, it did work. But you see what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's pragmatic.
Oh, fascinating. It's very interesting. How does, I know we're kind of taking broad strokes here. There's obviously so many details to go deeper into when it comes to these, you know, big philosophical movements and many other philosophers themselves. But how does Freud fit into this image?
Well, it makes me think of, you know, Yaki's book. He mentions three figures that he, I'm not advocating everything that Yaki said, but I do think his book Imperium was an interesting read. I'm more so a fan of Spengler than I would be Yaki, but, you know, he mentions three figures that kind of stand out as preeminent in the history of Western ideas. And he says it's Marx, Freud, and Darwin. And these three kind of become the new prophets of modernity. And what they do is revolutionize, you know, any kind of traditional ways of living or religious thinking or whatever in every area of life. You know, Marx revolutionizes economics, Freud revolutionizes psychology and anthropology, and Darwin revolutionizes biology and the sciences. So basically you have anything metaphysical or anything potentially beyond the here and now removed. And so with Freud, what we have is an obsession with the over-sexualization of man, or an over-sexualized picture of man that essentially baser drives are the only thing that impel or motivate humans. Any previously, like I said, organic or the nuclear family, anything like that, is directly subverted with the idea that that, you know, even in your family unit, you know, it's all based around sex.
And so, right. Yeah.
So I think Freud was kind of the spearhead of the subverting of the mind, of psychology, psychiatry, anthropology.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Well, we had definitely much more to discuss here, Jay. It's very interesting. In the second, I want to talk much more about movies as well and how this, because you've spent a lot of time analyzing entertainment, a lot of the latest movies. You also revisit and go back to, you know, older movies and take this kind of philosophical approach to it, which is just an excellent way of analyzing and deconstructing some of the messages we get. So I really want to talk more about that in the second. But let's just talk about your website a little bit, where people can go to find more of your writings and how often you post stuff. I think you have a radio show or podcast as well, right?
I do. I pretty much just post any interviews that I do. They go up as just a normal blog post or whatever. My site is jaysanalysis.com. You know, you can just Google that, type it in, it'll come up pretty easy. I try to do every day. I've gotten a lot more disciplined in the last 6-8 months because it, as you know, I'm sure the more content that you put out that's at least somewhat quality, you know, the better that is. So I try to do every day. You'll find everything from comparative religion to film analysis to geopolitics. And the last, like I said, the last 2-3 months have really, really picked up. So I've had some articles that have gone pretty viral, you know, a few 100,000 views, which is pretty interesting for movie analysis. You know, you don't think about that kind of stuff catching on, but that's what people like to read. They like to look at pop culture and say, well, maybe there's actually something deeper that we can think about here.
Well, they do. Exactly. That's why it's amazing how much power, you know, pop culture has.
It is.
And even for this reason, and even when it comes to deconstructing it or analyzing it, it's been some of the most popular things we've had up to. And part of me says, unfortunately, because I like it too. It's interesting, and we should spend time deconstructing it. It's very important, if not the most important thing. You know,
I wish that I could just sit and do philosophy lectures all day and try to get people into critical thinking. But you know, they're gonna read an analysis of Back to the Future before they're gonna listen to me drone on about metaphysics.
Whatever. Yeah. Yeah, I know. Well, it's a good lead way in there. I don't know how much you thought about that as a backdrop, though, but that's a clever way of doing it. So good job on that, you know. All right, the website jasonanalysis.com. We're going to have that up on redicecreations.com, so do check it out. We'll be right back with Jay here. We're going to talk much more in the second hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back.